You're listening to Stand Out with Ian O'Connell, Wednesday evenings from 8pm here on Radio Kerry.
Now, you're very welcome to the show tonight. I hope I find you well on this Wednesday evening. Another scorcher of a day. It was great to have the sun out again. We're kind of counting the days. Everybody I meet were saying, "Where odds changing on Friday." I said to them, enjoy today and on Thursday tomorrow, because Thursday's supposed to be a scorcher tomorrow. So enjoy it and don't be one of them people that are always saying that the weather's changing and it's supposed to go back to Irish weather on Friday. Enjoy it while it lasts and stay positive about it, I tell them. I just want to say a massive congratulations to the Kerry senior football team with a massive win over Armagh on the weekend. I suppose it's great to, I know that it was kind of, before the game we were kind of thinking, will we be there, will it be a close game? And I suppose they had an exhibition of what Kerry football is on Saturday evening in Killarney, because they put on a massive show, I suppose. David Clifford, the story of the game again, clicking a goal and 10 points. It's kind of standard by him now, and everybody's just used to it. So well done to all the Kerry team and the backroom staff. I have a very, very interesting guest for you tonight. I suppose a lot of people would have heard of his story there recently over the last 3 or 4 weeks. I suppose the end of May, he done something that not everybody would do. So I'm delighted to say that my guest this week on Standout with myself, Ian O'Connell, is Waterford man Adam Sweeney. Adam recently became the youngest Irish person to summit Mount Everest at just 22 years of age. Adam and his teammates were the first all-Irish crew to complete an Everest summit in over 2 decades after a grueling 47-day expedition in May of 2026. I know one of the guys that was with them, Jason, had to turn around through injury as they were making their way up, but he has plenty of experience and he was down at the base guiding them through it and keeping everybody up to date on social media. So I'm really looking forward to my chat with Adam. And I hope you all enjoy it too. So sit back and enjoy the show. Adam, thanks so much for joining me today. I'm delighted to have you on the show. I was one of many people following yourself and the lads there over the last number of weeks, what she done. So thanks so much for coming on. How are you?
Good now. Yourself. Thanks for having me on. I'm delighted to be here.
I like to ask my guests at the start, Adam, I suppose, just to paint a picture for the listeners. You're from Waterford, I suppose. Growing up, I suppose when you say Waterford, kind of hurling comes to mind. Did you have any interest in other sports as a young fella?
Yeah, so I wouldn't be the best hurler. I think I did it for about a week, but I was too bad at it, so I have to give that up. And I did Gaelic, the same thing. But I kind of played football and rugby when I was younger. And then as I got older, I kind of got more into sports where it's kind of just you out and about and stuff like that. So that's where I kind of grew. My family actually own a business down here, Dunmore Adventure, so it's a water sports centre. So I was always thrown in the water and stuff like that. And yeah, it was fairly opposite from sea level where we went anyways.
I actually go down to Waterford at Christmas, down to the Christmas market some years. It's a lovely spot.
Yeah. So, they got the water, what was it, the winter market of the year or of the Europe or something like that. Fair play to them.
Yeah, there was some big one. I was down there, I suppose, 2 years ago was my last time down there. So it was kind of all water sports, so kind of that kind of side of things. Did you done a bit of cycling as well later on, didn't you?
Yeah, so it kind of all started in transition year. I kind of wanted to do something, so I hopped on the bike and cycled around the country. And I was like, I don't want to do something that everyone's kind of done, so I decided to add in the highest peak in every county I went through. Now, before this, like, I had done zero mountaineering. Like, the first mountain we went up to didn't bring a jacket or anything like that. And sure, you know, in Ireland, it's raining constantly, like, so you can imagine how that went. I was absolutely freezing the entire winter, right? I might need to get myself locked in a bit here. So got a jacket and stuff like that and went around. I just love the mountains ever since. And kind of from then, it spiraled up to what was the tallest mountain in the world.
And I suppose, did you enjoy school when you were younger?
Yeah, I was a bit of a mess now. I'd say the teachers didn't love me too much, but having the crack, I'm sure you know yourself now. It was good to go in, talk to the lads and all like that. But yeah, definitely did enjoy school.
I always say the teacher said to me, I get nowhere by talking in class, and I met one of them recently and I said, I'm talking on the radio now. So that kind of day, I gave them a bit of a doing over that.
I'd say you were laughing at them.
they were laughing themselves. I suppose when after the cycling, when did the I suppose the vision of Everest kind of come? Because it's not something you said I'm going to do in 6 months' time. There's a long road leading up to it.
Yeah, so I kind of had an idea for a while. Like, my mother would be very into Shackleton and Everest and all that. So when we were growing up, we had always heard stories about it. So I kind of, I and in TY, in fact, there was a lady called Jenny Keller. She came in. She had done Everest, so she came into school and she was talking about it. And I think from then it kind of stemmed on. So I decided, right, what can I do next? And went over with my brother to do the Three Peaks, and then we did that, and it was fairly hard. So that's the highest mountain in the in England, Ireland, and no, sorry, England, Scotland, and Wales. So you have to do that in 24 hours, and then just kind of kept going. So I went over to South America to the highest mountain in South America, Aconcagua. That was 6962. So my previous one had been 1,300 meters. Going to 6962 was a big jump.
Big
But look,
jump.
we got up that eventually, and then I got a call off a man called Jason Black, who was our lead over there, and he says, right, I've got a team going 2026. This is what I'm doing. This is this, and f it, that was just a huge help because it kind of made like a dream a reality at that point then.
And like, how did you find adjusting to obviously the kind of climate and the altitude? Did you, because obviously Ireland and England and stuff, it's obviously nowhere near Everest, so was it the mountains when you travel over that you kind of got to see the altitude?
It's tough. I find it really tough to eat on the mountains. So for like, especially on Everest now, I was probably 5 or 6 days with having no more than 2 packs of ramen noodles in that space. So that's kind of my big problems on high mountains. But yeah, look, it's just weird. It just feels like you're lightheaded all the time. So you just want to get that point where, right, I don't want to be too lightheaded to the point where something might happen here. So you kind of have to balance that because you're not going to feel good on those mountains at all.
And did you think that people, I suppose, they don't realize the mountains in Ireland and what we have on our doorstep?
Yeah, look, well, that's the thing with it. Like, everyone's kind of like, oh, how do you train for Everest? And they asked the lads as well, but like 99.9% of my training was done in the locals' hills, going down to Cairn Toul or going up north or anything like that. Like, there's so many mountains around in Ireland. Now, of course, if you want to get the altitude, you have to go to the Alps every now and then. But geez, I'd say we must have done 3 big trips before we went over. You know what I mean? That kind of shows you the extent of how much training was done in Ireland and what can be done in Ireland. Like,
Exactly. And I suppose I had Padraig O'Hara on my show going back, I suppose, 3 years ago now. But how important was having a team, obviously, that you know, first Irish team in so long, I suppose, because individually you're kind of in your own head, but when you have people by your side going up, does it make a difference?
absolutely massive. Yeah, like even having like, you know, the tricolor in your bag and like you're like, right, I want to get this to the back to the top of the world again, you know what I mean? But like when we went up the first time, and unfortunately we had to come down, so we were 8 hours trying to get up to the summit. It should have taken us about 4 hours to get where we were. So at that point we had to come back down to our tents, and then we were in the dead zone for almost 2 days overall. So that second time when we had to crawl out of the tent, I don't think any of us would have gotten out of the tent if it wasn't for each other there. Because you're kind of looking at each other and saying, right, I'm not going to give up unless they give up. And they're saying the exact same thing. So having a team, as you know yourself, like having a team around you is just absolutely massive. Like,
It's very important, like, just to have them by your side. Do you think that people don't realize the Sherpas over there? Like, they do unbelievable work just from watching documentaries and stuff. I don't think people realize how important they are they?
They're just the nicest people you'll ever meet in your life. And like, it's funny, they love what they do. Like, you go over and like, we had a 24-year-old Sherpa leading us, which is kind of deadly. So this is his first time leading the group, and the passion this man had. Like, when we had to turn around that first time, he was more upset than everyone else. And then when he knew we had a second chance, he was like, let's go, you know, he's trying to hype us up. But like, the weight they have to carry, all they have to do, you know, we get up, you're up there and you're in your tents and stuff like that. And they've after carrying oxygen bottles before. And then they're passing food and stuff like that, and they're chilling, they're chatting, they're having the crack. But like, also just they support them. Like, they're so nice. Like, aside from the work they do, like, which is absolutely incredible, they're the nicest people you'll ever meet in your life. And people like that you'll be friends with for the rest of your life. You know, we're still having in contact with them and stuff like that. So you kind of create a bond from being on a mountain after 2 months.
I was going to say that, like, you build a bond with them when you're with them for so long. Is it kind of like down at base camp, down before you even set off for the main? Is it kind of like a little village because you see loads of flags and stuff in pictures.
Yeah, it is a little bit now. I think there's a virus outbreak in one camp, so everyone was kind of advised, right, stay in your own little pod. So there wasn't much traveling to kind of other camps. And then also, I think afterwards, where people kind of meet up, but we, sure, because we're so late, everyone had to kind of get out of it. But yeah, look, it's so nice. It's so nice down there. Like, you kind of, if you're walking out of it, it's massive base camp. It takes about an hour and 15 minutes to walk through or something like that. So that walk was not nice at the end of the day, but yeah, it's beautiful over there, and you're looking around at these mountains, and they're absolutely massive. But you can hear avalanches about three or four times a day, and at the start you're like, "Poof, this is kind of scary," and then by the end of it, sure, like if there's no avalanche, you're like, "Jesus, what's happened up in the mountain? Like, is something bad happening?"
That's amazing. And you know, that time you had to turn back at him when you went up for the second attempt, then did you have that in the back of your head that it might happen again?
I think when we were coming back down, like when we had to come back down the first time, I think that's when everyone was kind of doubting and stuff. We didn't know if we could go again. We didn't know if we had enough oxygen. Thank God we had Jason down below in base camp who could organize the stuff for us. And then that second time, like, yeah, there's doubts creeping into your head, but we kind of said before, and we said, right, we'll get out of this tent and we'll give it our best shot. Like, there wasn't. No one really had full confidence in we're going to do it because, look, we'd been doing something for 8 hours in the dead zone, which, and it was brutal up. Like, you take one step up, you move three quarters back. So everyone's kind of doubting it. But then as we started to go on and we got up to a certain point and we met the point where we had been yesterday, everyone was feeling kind of comfortable. So from then on, we just kicked on. But to see the summit, oh, I was absolutely buzzing because there's the amount of false summits up there. You think, oh, that's it. And then now later, that's it. But you can always see something in the background. And like, well, I know it's got to be the highest thing, doesn't it? Like,
Did you watch any? I suppose I watched a documentary, Vogue Williams' husband Spencer Matthews,
yeah.
about his brother up there. He going up. Any of them kind of documentaries or stories? Did you ever kind of say, is it worth the risk?
So I had watched Spencer Matthews one actually, and I'd avoided kind of the rest. I was like, you know what,
Yeah.
I'll avoid it till afterwards. But it's funny because we went over and we were waiting down a place called Ding Bache, and in the cafes over there they play Everest every day. So we went down and we went down and we watched it. I think this must have been a week before or 2 weeks before we went for our summit attempt. So that was the first time I'd seen that. But I think you're so confident in your training, like. Everyone who goes over there and something bad happens to them, they're so confident they're training as well. But like, you have each other, and look, things go wrong. You're aware of the risks, but I think you're kind of in your head, you're like, the risks are worth it for you because it's just, I know there's a bigger meaning behind just the tallest mountain in the world. It's about testing yourself and stuff like that. So getting over there, yeah, look, it's hard for the family and stuff because they've seen all the movies and stuff. So they think, because you know, you kind of hear all the bad things. A lot of the time, you don't hear the good things over there. The death rate, thankfully, has gone down quite a lot and stuff. So yeah, you're aware of it, but at the end of the day, you're trying to kind of avoid it. But now I'm watching all the movies, seeing what's going on. It's weird because you're kind of looking at it and you're like, wow, that's insane. I was on that.
Does it make it more even meaningful and bigger when you see them, knowing that you got up and down safely?
Yeah, I think it does. I think it does. There was a big thing because, of course, Jason was kind of doing. He heard when we summoned it, so he had a live podcast. There was loads of people on it or a live Instagram,
I remember
and.
seeing that, yeah.
Yeah, it was really cool. It was really nice. And he was saying everyone was buzzing. They were all like, they've gotten up, but sure, look, the most dangerous part's the way down. Like, and it took us a lot longer. One of the boys was a bit sick. So it took us a lot longer to get down to than it should have. But look, at the end of the day, thankfully, we did get down.
I was going to say that about Jason updating on Instagram and everything. Were you aware, Adam, I suppose, on the way up how big it was back home and how many people were looking for updates and kind of tracking it?
Hadn't a clue because you've no Wi-Fi for about 6 days. So you jet off and Jason head off with us. So he made a decision at Camp 2 to turn around. So we thought he was going to stay in Camp 2, but he ended up going out to base camp because, to be honest, there's no point staying in Camp 2. It's not the nicest, and he can do more from base camp. You know, the directors of the companies are down there, so he can have a chat with them. But yeah, coming down and seeing that video, I remember coming down afterwards and we'd summited it. And you're a bit emotional. You're on a high, you're absolutely buzzing, you've got down safe. And then watching that video and the tears were coming out, like, just it was so nice. And everyone back home was so supportive. Because like, yeah, like reading those comments afterwards and being like, wow, that means a lot. And even people saying like their kids and like their primary school teachers and their class has been following the whole time. Like just to hear that's kind of why I do it. Look, I got inspired by someone who came into my school and had a chat. So hopefully I can do that over the next little while.
It is not amazing. And did Jason, did he pick up an injury on the way up that he had to turn around there?
Yeah, he did, unfortunately. So I think it was actually on a previous trip he had done it, but then it kind of healed. And then next thing he went over to Amadab and it just twisted on a rock. It was a ligament off the bone or something like that. So he said, lads, I'll be putting you at risk if I go up. And at the time, you're kind of like, ah, you can push it. But looking back, it was completely the right decision to make. Like,
And are you in contact with Jason down at base camp, Adam?
No, not really. So the signal wasn't great. So he had a walkie-talkie, and he was signaling up to Camp Two, and then Camp Two would go up to us. So it was kind of like, and the language barrier a bit. But every now and then you kind of hear, and you'd ask like, right, what's the weather like? That was brilliant actually to have, just to know, okay, you're good to go. You know, the weather's safe. Because after watching Everest 2 or 3 weeks prior, I know what the weather's like. You don't really want to be going up in anything bad.
What was it like? I suppose one of the when I see kind of documentaries and stuff, like I say, the big thing I see is, you know, the kind of crevice where they put the ladder from one side to the other. What is that like?
Yeah, that is it's funny at the start you're kind of loving it because you're not really that tired. So the first time you go up you're like, this is absolutely class. And it's right at the end of the ice fall, which is very dangerous this year. So to get through it you're absolutely buzzing. But yeah, it's cool. It is very cool. It's scary. You try not to look down, but then I remember coming back after summit and coming over this ladder and you're really wobbly on your feet. But to be honest, yeah, we were all saying we would have been very disappointed if they didn't have the ladder because it's kind of part of the mountain. Yeah, you see all those videos and stuff like that. But yeah, we got over them nice and safe. But apparently there was a few people that did fall in. They were kind of hanging there for a little bit. But thankfully, no one fell in properly to that one.
How would you practice for that back at home for
I
the kind
actually
of
didn't. I didn't practice for that now. So when you go over, you do about like a week's training over there. And so you do the ladders over there. So you kind of just learn the ropes. And in fairness, it's fairly handy. It looks harder than it is. Your crampons, which is spikes on your feet, they kind of click into the ladder perfectly. So it's not too bad. But yeah, thankfully we didn't fall in.
And are them ladders left there permanently?
No, so they're taken out. All the ropes on the mountain are so. Before and after the season, they're put in by lads over there, and they go right somewhere, and then they go up and they take all the ropes, ladders down. But like they're maintained constantly, so the ice fall is shifting. I think it's about 1 meter a day. So every day, I think the SPCC, which is the people that fix all the stuff over there, they go up and they actually fix the ladders. So fair play to them, like, because that's a good old walk up to there.
They're putting themselves at risk as well, like, aren't they?
Oh, they are. They really are. They really are. And like, look, you actually cannot give any of them enough credit. Like, it's insane what they're doing. But they're so passionate about the mountain and they're cleaning up the mountain. So it's kind of nice, like, and then you kind of speak to them and just what they're doing. It's technically what they're doing is a job, and no one wants to go to work and end up dying or anything like that. So what they do, just she can't give enough credit. And look, I'm sure you heard the story about the Sherpas who unfortunately didn't make it, and that hurts a lot more because you know they did go into work. But look, just huge credit to what they've done.
Is it more common than people think, Adam, that people don't make it back down?
I think it is getting better. I think it is getting better now. It was 5 this year and 2 was natural causes, but it's still 5 too many. And one of them, like, it's fairly sad stories. But yeah, I think it is getting better. In fact, what's going on, because it is a lot safer. People now, they're bringing in the 7,000 meter rule, so you have to next year you have to have a 7,000 meter peak done before you go over to climb Everest, which is makes a lot of sense. Like, there's a fellow over there I was talking, and he had only done Everest Base Camp. I know Everest Base Camp is no mean feat, but it's a world away from Everest. Like, you're not getting any rope skills. So I think from now on, hopefully it'll be less crowded and also it'll be a lot safer because a lot of people are kind of trying to jump in this year to do it before the 7,000 meter rule comes in. But that needs to be done. You kind of have to have a 7,000 meter peak but done before because you don't know how your body react or anything like that. So hopefully it will be less common.
And like the base camp and the death zone, are they far from each other? When does the altitude actually kind of start affecting people?
Yeah, so base camp's about 5,500. So you can be affected anywhere. Like, we got up and poor had to go down He was just losing oxygen. So the second we got up, we had to go back down just to kind of get feel a bit better. So we went back down, and then once we got back up, it was fine. But base camp, I mean, what is it? Camp 4 is 8,000 meters, so that's the dead zone. When you're sitting in there, you can't eat, you can't sleep, you feel kind of horrible. Anything you do, any little movement is tough. So yeah, there's a big jump up there. Base camp, you're trying to eat as much as you can. But even like that, we were over there for 2 months. We were meant to be there for about 5 weeks. And sitting in base camp for that long, you can feel your body kind of going down. You know, you're starting to not eat. You might get food poisoning, something like that. You might have to go back down, which isn't great. So, but look, at the end of the day, that's kind of what you sign up for.
I suppose when you're not eating, then you don't have as much energy to go on.
Yeah, that's a big thing. I think I lost about 10 kgs over there, kind of
Boy.
10 kgs I didn't have to lose. And it's kind of it attacks your muscles first, and then it's your fat. So coming back, like, you look very, very skinny. But look, you can easily put it back on because I'm eating some load over here now. But yeah, it is. It's so hard to eat. And like, I think up in the dead zone, if you're sitting down, you're burning about 15,000 calories a day. Like, your heart rate's resting at 130 beats per minute, something like that. It could be even higher. So like, you can imagine how many calories you'd be burning. Like, you're never going to get that. Even on sea level, getting 15,000 calories into your day would be a mean feat now.
It's still a lot, like,
Yeah.
I suppose I was gonna to ask you when you did get up to the summit, I suppose, what was that feeling like?
Yeah, it was some relief like that. I've never felt like a wave of emotion kind of came over me. And it was just so cool because the three of us got there together, which was so nice because we were all thinking, right, will we get here? And the three of us to get there was absolutely amazing. Alongside the Sherpas, like, they were absolutely buzzing, taking photos and stuff like that. We all got photos together. But then you have to be like, okay, right, we have to lock in now because we have to get down. I believe that day was the most summits on Everest in history. So I think there was 270 something people at summit. So
What?
yeah, it was mad. Like, we were first up there because there was no weather window this year because the ice fall opened so late. So first two weather windows were gone, and then that was pretty much the only good day. So everyone had went for it. So we went up. Thankfully, we went up early. And we summited in the dark. We said we'd make that decision because everyone will want to go to sunrise for sunrise. So we left about 3 or 4 hours ahead of people, and that gave us a big help. But come back down, it was absolutely mental. People, you're attached in, and you're clipping around people. So you have two lanyards, so you clip around people, and people are unclipping you and stuff like that. So it's mad, and you're screaming at them because at the end of the day, it's your life. You're not really gonna be like, sorry, would you mind not unclip me when there's a 2,000 meter drop on me, right? Like. But yeah, we were thankful to get down to Camp 4 now because it was absolutely exhausting.
Was the majority of the climb, as you mentioned there, and nighttime, was there the majority during kind of daylight hours and just nighttime at the summit, or?
So we left at around 3:30 during the day. So we had about till, I don't know, 8 o'clock, and then the rest of it was kind of in the night. But even like that, people say about, oh, the sunrise pics. Look, the pics we got from the top were absolutely dreadful, but we didn't care about that. We were up there for about 5 minutes, got back down, but then sitting down looking at that sunrise on the way down was something else, and seeing the curvature of the world, it was unbelievable. That was kind of magic. I think the sun rose about 4:30 over there. So like, seeing that was insane. So we didn't have long to wait for that. So that was absolutely beautiful. So thankful we did get a bit of sunshine.
Is there, you said this year it was kind of different with the ice fall. What are the, is there main climbing seasons, you said?
Yeah, so every year there is that's so there's 2 months that of the year that they climb. They actually take the ropes down when Tenzing Norgay and Edmund Hillary, the first people to climb Everest, when they had summited, they take the ropes down that day. So that's kind of Everest Day over there. But yeah, there's a main season, but unfortunately, in the ice fall this year, there was a huge, huge sérac, probably the size of a 4-story building. That was it. It looked like it was ready to collapse. So eventually and there's no other way around it, but eventually they did find a way to get through. It was mad because during the section you're speaking to each other, and they're like, right, for this section you have to run, and you're like, oh my days, like, you're really feeling nerves there, and running up there is really, really difficult. And then when you get to the other side, you're just so relieved because you're like, thank God that didn't fall. One of the lads who went over with actually saw a serac fall. And it kind of shook him the first little bit, but look, he got over it, no bother. But he kind of saw that, and he's like, right, this is fairly serious in here now. But yeah, luckily it didn't fall. I'm surprised it didn't, because every time you walk past it, the crack went from what was like 2 centimeters to a meter and a half. So it looked like it was going to fall, but it didn't, thankfully.
It's mad, like thinking about it, isn't it? Like one fall and like it's so, it's such a fine line, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a fine line, and kind of telling the stories. You don't tell these stories to the family until you get back, all the kind of horror stories. But yeah, that's it. Look, you could go over and you could be as fit as possible. Next thing, this thing falls down, and there's nothing you could do. There's no way you're getting out of the way of it. There's no way you could do anything about it. But yeah, luckily it didn't. Luckily it didn't, because that was a big fear for me, and I know for the team and everyone back home, to be honest with you. Because look, everyone knew the news about the Serac, and they knew the crack, and they saw a photo, and they were like, right, that is fairly serious. But yeah, we got around it, thankfully.
And like you said, your mom, the company back at home, she was obviously fully aware what Everest is like, and what it's the risks going up there. What was her kind of reaction when you said you were going doing it?
You know what, in fairness, like, that's the nice thing about my family. Probably when I mentioned it 3 or 4 years ago, I said I want to do Everest. They were like, right, let's see how we're going to do it. Let's make this possible. So that was really nice, because I know, like, a lot of people, their parents might be not be supportive and say, nah, there's no way you're doing that. But from the second I said it to when I did, like, they were fully behind me. Now, bless them, they didn't sleep for a month. You could see when I came home, they had a lot of bags underneath their eyes. But yeah, look, she's kind of said, now, next time you're doing something like this, don't tell me. But I know she would want to know. But yeah, look, they were all delighted, and it's such a big thing. And I genuinely wouldn't have been able to do it without them, because even like some days, if I have an off day for training, they're like, right, you need to get out and train. So all that stuff was really nice. And afterwards, they helped me out with photos and stuff, because you'd still be a bit tired after it. So that was absolutely massive, and I was delighted to have all that support.
How important was Jason, I suppose, going up, but then to have him down at base camp?
Yeah, he was absolutely huge. Look, he had put this team together years ago, and we kind of spoke about it and said, Jason, this would not have happened without you, realistically. And we were kind of saying that more as he had to go down. But yeah, look, just to know that someone has done, he has a wealth of experience. He's done K2, he's done Everest. So like, he's got like an absolute huge trophy case. So kind of to have someone that you could speak to saying, what's this like? What's this like? How should I do this? How should I do this? Was r massive. And then kind of the confidence he fills you with as well. He was like, lads, there's nobody going to be able to do this. I'm 100% sure. So like, kind of getting that from someone who has done so much was absolutely massive. And then like that, he had to go down to base camp. And when we failed our summit attempt the first time, he organized all the stuff the second time. I think the director said, because it's you don't stay in the dead zone for 2 days. But Jason said, no, they have another one in us. We were kind of speaking, and he said, they have another one in us. So he organized auction bottles up to us, and then we had to get a new Sherpa. One of the other lads had to go down. So without him, the summit definitely wouldn't have been possible. Never mind the second attempt, the first attempt wouldn't have been possible.
And the way you said when you go over, is it like a week's kind of training you said you do? What does that entail?
So it's actually great crack. So you go over, you do the ladders, and then you're just going around on a Jumar. So the ascender device that you use a lot of the way, so going up, you use that, and then you're kind of it's only on the icefall has little pointy bits. They're probably only 15, 20 meters tall or something like that. So it wasn't too bad. So what you do is you go up, you go across, you be laid down. We've all done it before, but it's just to kind of nail that, and then you had to do a bit of ice climbing, which was really cool. Now, thankfully, we didn't have to use that on the way down. That would have been if the ropes got wiped out or anything like that. But thankfully, they didn't. But look, you're over there to have a bit of crack. And in fairness, we were fairly confident with a lot of it beforehand. A lot of people you could see hadn't done anything before, and they needed a few more days. But yeah, look, it was about having the crack and being confident. Just kind of having the skills to go again, because you'd forget if you had done it 6 months prior, and then it just comes back to you straight away, like.
What's the climbers? Obviously, you said the Sherpas, they bring the kind of oxygen and stuff. What's the climbers there like? Because there is a lot of gear to bring up.
Yeah, so you have to bring, you're wearing your down suit a lot of the way. So you have to kind of bring your sleeping bag. You have to bring all your bedding and stuff like that. So you've got like a pad underneath you. Then we took oxygen from camp two. We were meant to take it from camp three, but just because the season got delayed so much, we didn't have enough time to do as many rotations as we would have liked. So you have to take an oxygen bottle then as well. So that's 4 kgs. But she can't complain, like, because the Sherpas are bringing 4 oxygen bottles in their bag. Like, you feel their bag, and it's insanely heavy. Like, it was really funny. We walked in actually from Lukla, to base camp, which is about an 8 day trek. And the Sherpa, he didn't have to wear a lot of weight, but he's like, nah, you know what? I like wearing weight. This is my training. And he was jogging on, and you put on this man's bag, and it weighs an absolute ton. But look, they're different grade, they're beasts, like.
It is. It's mad. I heard an interview. I don't know, was it one of your family or someone that I think was this, I forget who it was, but they said the kind of local village became Everest experts kind of overnight.
Yeah, it's funny actually. Coming back, you kind of don't realize everyone's coming up and saying, "Geez, I hadn't slept for a week. I hadn't slept for a week." But yeah, they were coming up to me, ma'am, and asking about the ice fall and the ice fall docks and the crevasses, and no one knew about it beforehand. Like that, it was cool that the whole village jumped on it, and it's nice walking down the street. Everyone coming up and saying, "Oh, how are you getting on? I haven't seen you in ages." But yeah, look, we're a small village here, so you kind of know everyone. So as soon as anyone's doing anything, everyone knows your business, like, so this is a fairly big thing for the village. But yeah, it was huge support, and it was really nice as well, because a lot of people might be older here, and they wouldn't have Instagram or anything like that, but they downloaded Instagram, so you could see them commenting on all your posts. So that was lovely as well, like.
When you shared it on social media, you kind of started on that. Is that something that you planned on doing, or was it just kind of build traction over time?
Yeah, so I'd hope to look. The huge thing with Everest is the cost, as a lot of people know. And unfortunately, as a student, I probably wouldn't have. I think it was probably 55 grand lying around.
A lot,
So,
like, isn't it?
yeah, it is. It's and honestly, it was harder than the training, because the training you can go out and you can do and you enjoy. But raising that money, like, there was a point in the trip, and I thought I can't do this, because I didn't think I'd be able to get it. I eventually rallied it together, just about. I think I paid my last 1,000 the day before we left, like. But people are so supportive in that element. But yeah, so I kind of announced it for that reason 2 years ago. I think it must have been 3 years ago now, when I did, after I finished Aconcagua. So I did that. But then when we went over, I think people kind of wanted to know, and it's kind of nice to look back on, and you can kind of see, oh geez, I nearly forgot about that. But yeah, so that's kind of nice, and it got people involved back home as well, which is cool. And look, at the end of the day, if someone can take anything from those videos and say, look, I can kind of go do a 5K, or I can go do a 10 or a marathon or something like that, then it's all worth it.
Have you gotten a lot of messages from people?
Yeah, I have huge amounts. Look, I actually haven't gotten back to people still. Just the amount of messaging, they're so nice, just kind of saying loads of stuff. Just straight after someone, it was mad coming down, and you almost open up your phone and you're shocked, like, because it's mad getting it. But I'm delighted. I'm over the moon, and I couldn't thank people who support me enough, like.
It probably did surprise you, the power of social media, did it?
It's great, like, you know yourself, like, back in the day, you didn't have to do social medias. A lot of the previous mountaineers didn't have to do it, but now it's everything now, essentially, isn't it?
Is there a bit of camaraderie around between the climbers over when you are in base camp? Like, did you get to kind of mingle with other nationalities that were going doing it?
Yeah, so we had an Armenian, an American, and a Spanish, and as well Chinese in our tent. So you're with them for about 3 or 4 weeks. So in fairness, you do have the crack with them. I think at the start they didn't really get the Irish humor, but eventually we knocked that into them anyways. But yeah, no, it was good buzz over there, and you're kind of seeing how are you getting on. They're asking you how are you getting on, and like that, you're also texting other climbers around the place and just seeing, well, what's your story, and maybe when are you going for your summit, or how are you feeling. So it is quite nice, because at the end of the day, you're all over there together. Only they know how you're feeling. So it is nice to have a little chat elsewhere.
It is 100%. I suppose since when you got home, what was it like adjusting back to kind of sea level after being up there for so long?
Yeah, I think mentally it was tough on days, because at the end of the day, you're getting up, all you're doing is you're eating, you're sleeping, and then you're going hiking. So it kind of mentally could be tough some days. You're kind of saying you're on such a high, and then you come down and you're like, right, what do I do now? But adjusting sea level was great. Getting the oxygen in, getting the food in, it was absolutely lovely. Getting a chicken fillet roll was great. But yeah, no, it can be funny at times, and even now it still hits you some days, where you're kind of like, geez, I'd love to be back over there. But it still feels like a dream. It hasn't fully set in yet, and I wonder, will it ever? And I think I was talking to lads, and they were saying the same thing. So hopefully it will sink in one day, because it doesn't feel real just yet.
Especially being the youngest in Ireland to do it, having that title. I suppose that you mentioned there mentally before we finish up, Adam. People say obviously physically it's very hard on the body, you know, going doing this in the training. But like anything, any challenge, I suppose mentally is another side.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And people can kind of sleep on what it does for you. If you're mentally exhausted for so many days and you don't want to do it. Like, there's so much more your mind can do than your body. Like, at the end of the day, your mind will tell you what's going on. So you can really feel that once you're over there. Your mind is constantly saying, everyone's like, how are you feeling going up? Sure, all you want to do is turn around, and your mind is constantly telling you to turn around, but you're just like, right, just keep going, keep going, keep going. So you try to keep on going. But yeah, that's why it was so big having the team, because if you had those down days, they try and cheer you up, and they'd have those down days, and then it's the same thing back to them. So that's why it's so nice to be able to have a team over there to be able to talk about it, because you're not going to be mentally like delighted all the time, are you really? So it was nice having that.
Did you get any ideas from people over there that done other kind of expeditions or solo things that you'd like to do in the future?
Yeah, I think there's definitely a lot on the cards. That's kind of one problem of being the youngest Irish person to do it. I have a lot of years left to do these things, so I think definitely go back and do Everest. I think I'd like to do that solo, no oxygen, no Sherpas. I think that'd be kind of cool, and then probably looking at a hike, a walk across Antarctica or something like that. So that'll be a few years down the line yet, I'd say. But yeah, for now, rest up and get ready for the next one.
I was reading you volunteer with the RNLI as well.
Yeah, that's right. So I've been in there for I think the last 6 years. So it's a family affair there. My mother and my brother are in it as well. So it's kind of nice. It's a nice little thing for the village, you know, kind of get involved. So they were a big support as well over there.
Could you take anything from that onto the mountain?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, you go out and you could be out in the sea for 12, 13 hours, and you could be getting sick all over the place. So you kind of have to have a bit of mental strength out there at times. But yeah, absolutely. Kind of going out and again, waking up, sometimes a pager can go off 2 or 3 in the morning and you might have to run straight out the door. So you could take that into it as well, you know. You have to get out of your tent 2 in the morning, you're like, right, I've done this before, I can do this no bother. I can get out and give it a good go.
Were you studying anything before you went to do Everest?
Yeah, unfortunately, I deferred a few exams. So I have 12 exams coming up in August. So I'm
Okay,
doing
wait.
business final year. Yeah, I know everyone's coming up and saying, well, geez, if you can do Everest, you can do those 12, you can pass those 12 exams. I don't feel that way. So we'll see how they go in August. But the college were a big help to me as well. So we're kind of talking about how we can sort out a few of them. So I might only do half of them this year and then half next year. But yeah, it was nice to park it for a while, but now it's kind of getting closer. It says, right, I better get back into the books at some stage.
It's like anything, Adam, like when you stop something like doing TY for a lot of people, they kind of slack back on the work, and then you land in fifth year and you've exams and it's hard to get back into a bit of a routine, isn't it?
Oh, you're so right. You're so right. Sure, fourth year, you're messing the whole time. And then fifth year is almost the hardest year and stuff like that. Sure, it's even the summer holidays. You get summer holidays, you go back, and for the first month you're not concentrated at all, but then you have to kind of lock back in. But yeah, we'll see how that goes anyways.
Absolutely, Adam, you're a gent and I appreciate you coming on now, and all the best with everything coming up, the exams and the future and challenges. So I appreciate you coming on, so thanks so
Thank
much.
you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. You're an absolute gent.
Now that's always time for tonight, folks. I hope you all enjoyed the show and my chat with Adam Sweeney. I just want to say a massive thanks to Adam for coming on tonight. I know he's in a lot of interviews and doing a lot of media rounds lately, I suppose, with the accomplishment that himself and the team went through to summit Everest, so I'm really delighted that I got him on the show so soon after he doing the climb. So thanks a million to Adam Sweeney. If you have any suggestions, questions, or requests before next week's show, you can get in contact with me through my Instagram, enoconnell321, or as always, you can send me an email to my email address, ioconnell@radiokerry.ie. I hope you're all having a great week so far. Stay tuned in here to Radio Kerry because Brian Priestley is up next with That's Jazz. Enjoy the rest of the sun tomorrow. It's supposed to be the hottest day, like I said, so we'll make the most of it. And I'll be back at the same time next week from 8 to 9 p.m. Until then, stay safe and mind yourself.
You're listening to Standout with Ian O'Connell, Wednesday evenings from 8 p.m. here on Radio Kerry.